This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Winter Olympics have begun in Pyeongchang, just 50 miles south of the North Korean border. That's raised more than the usual concerns about Olympic safety. Up next, we have a story of a man who just last March crossed that border between North and South for the love of a sport. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Alex Fraycon is a 30-year-old copywriter and musician living in the Twin Cities. It's hard to describe how much he enjoys playing hockey. Beer league, he calls it. So I figured I'd let him tell you. In song. If Minnesota Nice and hip-hop were to have a baby, and that baby really loved hockey, the result would be the beer league anthem.
People ask why I still skate. At bad rinks when it's real late. Like, every game you get one fan. It's either some dude's wife or a girlfriend.
Last March, Alex Fraycon took a plane to Pyongyang, North Korea, handed his passport over to his tour guide slash minders, and stayed for a week. How did he get such a crazy idea?
Yeah, that's a question, surprisingly enough, I get a lot. I was on the internet, specifically as on this website called Reddit.
Reddit is an online community. People post stories, rants, articles, and web pages they've come across.
And I saw this post that simply said, hey, who wants to come to North Korea to play hockey with me? And I thought to myself, okay, you know, that sounds interesting. Very clickbaity.
The link took Alex to a website for the Howe International Friendship League, a sports tourism organization based in Canada.
And I X'd out of the window and I didn't think anything of it. I didn't even consider going. It wasn't a thing that I did. I didn't do those kinds of things. Like, I love adventure, but that to me was so foreign.
But somehow, the idea stuck. Alex decided to reach out to the man leading the trip. His name is Scott Howe.
My first email was so overwhelming. So I had questions about the hockey, questions about the travel, questions about the tourism aspect. I mean, it was extensive.
Alex and Scott exchanged 74 emails, and Alex still had a lot of concerns. Here's one you might not think about, unless you're a hockey player.
So the game of hockey, a lot of people who enjoy it, they have a great sense of humor, and they love, you know, it's called chirping, and it's very playful banter. But I was under the impression that, you know, humor was going to be a no-go there. Be prepared to be questioned, you know, be on guard all of the time. Those kinds of things, if that makes sense.
On the other hand, this was the opportunity to play hockey against a national team. Does the North Korean national hockey team have a reputation for being good?
Well... It's a very nice way of you know, asking the question. Let's say their talent has limitations. They're not the best hockey players in the world. Fine. That's fair. But the prospect of playing against a national team, given my skill level, that opportunity is going to come around once in a lifetime.
Alex jokes about his hockey skills, or lack thereof, but he's not a guy who likes to lose. So he looked up some videos of his would-be competition on YouTube.
They were old, but I got a feel. I was like, okay, I can hang. I think we have a good shot here.
Alex says he wasn't really thinking about politics.
Right.
You see, you sound skeptical.
Well, I mean, it's just, it's like, I don't know. I don't even know what I'm trying to say.
I hear you.
I think it would be a hard decision.
It was a hard decision, and I would be lying to you if I said I didn't consider that. And I talked at length with Scott about that. I was like, as an American, there's a lot to be discussed there. To me, the worst case scenario was maybe something is said in the political arena that forces the borders to get shut and I get stuck in this country.
Alex decided to go, but he only told two people, and they're not the ones you might expect.
I did not tell my mom and dad.
As far as his family, his coworkers, and his beer league teammates knew, Alex was going on a tour of China, Beijing, Shanghai, and Hong Kong.
I mean, if there's any kids listening, like, this was bad of me, I would be grounded for this for sure, but I remember having to Google things to do in Shanghai and Hong Kong, just in case people asked me. I could be like, oh yeah, I'm going to see this. It was an elaborate ruse. I know, I'm ashamed.
Alex's days were spent researching and planning, both for the trip he was taking and for the trip he was telling people he was taking. He says he didn't have time to get nervous until he actually boarded the plane in Beijing that would take him to Pyongyang.
The airline I took, I believe it's called Air Koryo, is the worst rated airline in the world.
The flight was uneventful. Alex landed in Pyongyang and breezed through customs. They didn't even look twice at the camera equipment he brought to document his trip, a gallon-sized Ziploc bag filled with his GoPro, extra batteries, and memory cards. In fact, everything went really smoothly until Alex's teammates arrived and 17 strangers had to figure out how to play hockey together.
In an ideal situation, I would have been the worst player on the team. But that was not the case. So we had a great range. We had one individual, I think it was his second time playing hockey ever. And I mean, talk about, you know, confidence. Not only are you willing to try a new sport, okay, but you're willing to try that new sport against a national team
in North Korea.
Not long after that revelation, the North Korean team took to the ice for warm-ups. That's when Alex learned how out of date those YouTube videos had been.
Got out on the ice and I was watching them warm up, and they're all skating in one big circle, very, very fast. And then all of a sudden, someone just kind of yells like, "Hut!" And they all stop on a dime, and just snow ominously kicks up, all in unison. And I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, we are going to lose. And I went skated over to Scott, and I was like, "Scott, we are in some trouble." And he's like, "Oh, no, we'll be fine." Well, spoiler, we were not fine.
All right. Just played our first warm-up friendly game, and we got squashed. What was the final score? 16-1? Something? 16, 15, 17? Get him next time.
Alex and his teammates did not get him next time. They lost every single game, and there were a lot of games.
We played about 6 hours a day, 3 in the morning, 3 in the evening, and in between then, we would tour all day. You know, it's nonstop.
Alex had only planned to use his GoPro during hockey games. He didn't think his tour guides would allow him to take videos outside the rink, but soon he found himself taking it with him everywhere.
I'll admit, I was nervous. Even though they were telling me it was okay, I would always ask permission every time. "Hey, can I film this? Can I film this?" And they almost started getting annoyed with me because they kept being like, "Yeah, it's fine."
So Alex recorded his time in North Korea from the 3-lane bowling alley where he bowled with hotel staff to the bus tours of Pyongyang and the surrounding countryside.
Please look at the building on your left. The building on your left is, what is it?
Train station, where we got it.
To the dinners, where he and his teammates were entertained with live music.
Asian polka is the best way for me to describe it, but it's awesome.
One day, as the group was visiting Pyongyang's Hollywood-style movie studio, one of the tour guides, her name is Miss Lee, turned to Alex and said,
"Alex, did you see what President Trump said?" And I just am in my mind, I'm like, "Oh no. Oh no, what did he say? Please don't let him have said anything about North Korea." And I said, "You know, no, Miss Lee, my phone doesn't work here. Like, I don't know. What did he say?"
Turns out, at least on this day, the president hadn't said anything about North Korea. Miss Lee explained that she'd heard something about the U.S. maybe pulling out of a U.N. humanitarian council. She just wanted to know why. Nothing more ominous than that.
She wasn't trying to communicate anything outside of curiosity. Our tour guides especially were extremely curious about all things United States. They're curious just like I am, and they asked the same questions I would ask.
Alex Fraycon had traveled to North Korea to satisfy his curiosity, but he was also there to play hockey. The last game of the tournament was a mixed team scrimmage. The North Korean players took off their national team jerseys, and everyone put on the jerseys of the Friendship League. Alex says at that moment, the North Korean players, who had been serious and competitive, changed.
Immediately, I was approached by two players from the national team, and they just pointed, you know, one, two, and then at me, three. And they pointed to the ice. And I was like, "Okay, yeah, we just made a line right there." I think to them, it was like, okay, we're so much better than this kid. We're going to get him to score. Like, that's going to be our joy. So I got this really awesome cross-eyes pass and caught this on my GoPro, obviously. I was just watching it. It was a beautiful pass. I kind of had this nice little semi-breakaway, and I shot it right into the goalie's pads.
Bad shot.
And so I go back to the bench, and I sit next to a, you know, North Korean player, and I'm just shaking my head, and he's kind of looking at me. And I said, you know, my shot, and I motion with my stick, and then I hit my shin pad. I go, oh, I shot it right into his pads.
Bad shot, no good. Yeah.
And without missing a beat, he kind of holds up his finger like, no. And he motions with his hand between his legs. No. Don't shoot it at the pads. Shoot it between the pads. He started laughing and I started laughing. But I realized, like, I just got chirped by a North Korean national hockey player.
Did you ever think that that would be part of your experience?
No, I never thought that would be part of my experience. And that's why I found it so enjoyable. It was crazy. The love for the game translates across the world.
After his flight back to Beijing, Alex had a more sobering task, telling his parents where he'd been.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear us? Please?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, let's get this over with.
So I made a slight change to my itinerary.
I'm nervous. I just said,
I was in North Korea the last week.
And then there was silence.
There was a long pause.
And I don't blame them.
Are you guys there?
Did they ever say anything?
I think the first thing my mom ended up saying was, well, that's a goofy thing to do. You know, it definitely deteriorated from that point. Some of my closest friends were, you know, didn't want to talk to me for a little bit. It was, for all of the positives that came out of this trip, and it was a great experience, you know, a lot of people just didn't know how to respond.
The Friendship League is getting ready to go back to Pyongyang in March for another tournament against the North Korean national team. With the travel ban, it's no longer possible for U.S. citizens like Alex Fraycon to attend, even if they wanted to.
If, and I'll say if 50 more times, if I were to ever go back, I would have a full and lengthy discussion with my family beforehand. I love you, Mom and Dad. You're the best.
Our story about Alex Fraycon's ice hockey adventure in North Korea was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. Canadian transplant Bernie Skirkowski says that when it comes to curling, the U.S. is a sleeping giant.
Think of a population as size as we have, and we only have 20,000 registered curlers in the country. There's no reason why we can't start making it bigger and bigger.
That's coming up from Only a Game from NPR. This week, we'd like to send our thanks to Pendelgeist, who called Only a Game the best sports podcast in a recent review. This podcast makes me feel that there can be compelling sports-based audio journalism, Pendelgeist wrote. Sports! And that's with 3 exclamation points. Thank you, Pendelgeist. And if you think we're the best sports podcast, or even if you just put us in the top 10, please consider leaving a review of your own on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You have access to the entire world of NPR with your smart speaker. Ask it to play NPR or your local NPR station to check the news while you get ready for work or fix dinner. There's a new radio in your house, and it's easier than ever to listen to Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and more. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local NPR station.
I'm Bill Littlefield. It's time for 3 stories you should know. This week, we've got one last Super Bowl story for you, and then we're going to move on to the Olympics. I'm joined by sports writer Eric Malinowski via Skype and by The Ringer's Claire McNear. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Bill.
Great to be back.
Claire, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I will finish this year of football. This week, Philadelphia celebrated the Eagles' first ever Super Bowl win, and it was all the cheerful chaos you could ever hope for with a victory parade. But as you guys might know, Philadelphia sports fans are not necessarily the most beloved fans around. So I've got 2 points here. First, I think it's time we let Philadelphia fans off the hook. Not just for the whole pelting Santa with snowballs thing, but all the years of diehardness around it. I think for better or worse, Philly fans love their teams more than just about anyone anywhere, and can we really blame them for that? And then my second point is that Philadelphia fans, more than supporters just about anywhere this side of Cleveland, tend to be pretty nihilistic about their team's chances. Which made a little bit of sense, particularly in recent years, with the Sixers and the Phillies in perpetual rebuild mode, and the Flyers and Eagles always not quite good enough. But now Philadelphia teams have had 2 championships in the last decade, and I think the time has come for Philly sports fans to stop moaning about their fate in life, or at least in sports.
Eric, you go along with that conclusion? Time to let Philly fans alone?
Yeah, I largely do. I have a personal caveat here. You know, I was born and raised in New York, became a New York sports fan, then moved out to northeastern Pennsylvania. So I was immersed into a large collection of Eagles fans, and then went to school in Boston. So in some ways, I've been sort of genetically engineered to sort of dislike Philly sports fans and everything that they stand for. But I'm honestly like really happy for Eagles fans. I'm a little bit curious to see sort of how they grapple with all of this newfound success. You know, this is going to take away a little bit of their identity. You can let go of the nihilism, but something's going to have to replace that part of the void. So I think they're going to have to go on a little bit of a journey of self-discovery here. But you know what? Winning the Super Bowl, sometimes you take the good with the bad.
I love the idea of football fans going on journeys of self-discovery. I await the result with bated breath. But Claire, I'm not going to argue with you about Philadelphia fans because you have obviously done your homework. I just would suggest that maybe generalizing about fans in any city is a little bit dangerous. I mean, Boston fans have the reputation of being very knowledgeable baseball fans. But boy, I've heard a lot of stupid, witless stuff in the stands at Fenway Park. So I'm not really sure that all of these generalizations work. But all that notwithstanding, hey, I'm with you. It's Philly's day, and I hope they enjoy themselves. And maybe the Sixers will be good, too. Who knows?
Well, I was just going to say, to generalize one last time, that I think the danger here is that when you combine unbridled sporting passion with the loss of the corresponding despair and championship losing streaks, I mean, maybe you just turn into a Boston fan. And with all due respect to Boston, I don't think anyone wants that.
Eric, your turn.
Well, the Olympics are here. Hooray! We made it another 2 whole years. So being the living, breathing, red-blooded Boston University graduate that I am, my favorite Olympic sport by far is men's ice hockey, Miracle on Ice and all of that. So when the preliminary round starts on Wednesday, it's actually going to be a little bit different this time around. It's going to mark the first Olympics in more than 20 years that are not going to feature any current NHL players. You know, the NHL is really tired of the Olympics coming in the middle of their season and shutting things down for 3 weeks. So the NHL will keep playing and the Olympics will continue on their merry way. I think this is actually a really good thing. Obviously, with, you know, the Olympics and their long history of amateurism in most sports, I think that in some ways it's kind of fun because it kind of brings the Olympic form of ice hockey a little bit back to its roots. It definitely levels out the playing field. You could really argue that Team USA is kind of the entry in the tournament here that sort of gets hit the hardest with the exclusion of NHL players. So if nothing else, it's definitely going to sort of increase the level of competition and parity. But also, I think most importantly, that it's going to serve as a great reminder that Olympic ice hockey, which features a much larger rink and some small but I think important rules differences, is fundamentally more dynamic and exciting, I think, than watching current NHL hockey. So it's going to be a better product. It's going to be a little bit different. It's going to take a little getting used to. But Team USA basically features a crop of, you know, unsigned NHL veterans and a handful of youngish never-beens. And you're going to get to watch that kind of a team take on the world. Count me in for that.
Claire, are you good with the change as well? And the NHL can stay home and it's all right with you?
Yeah, you know, I've got to agree with Eric. I know a lot of people have been bummed about this because, you know, who wouldn't want to watch an NHL exhibition game or match or series, rather, infused with nationalist fervor? But I think there's something to the Olympics being sort of the peak of for lack of a better word, amateurism, you know, the myth, and it very much is a myth, but the myth that, you know, maybe if you had just devoted your whole life to this thing, maybe you could be there too. I could not. I know that for sure, but maybe. And I don't think that that's what the NHL was going for here when they blocked players from going, but, you know, I'll take what I can get.
I think this alleged amateurism is as silly now as it was when Avery Brundage was in charge, and I don't buy it for a minute. And I wish the NHL players were still there because, hey, they're the best hockey players in the world. And what the Olympics has become, whether amateur, shamateur people like it or not, is an opportunity to watch the best athletes in the world do what they do. So I think it's a lot of baloney to say we're returning to some kind of amateurism. I think that's very silly, and I would welcome the best competing.
You're absolutely right, but that's the way the Olympics are. The Olympics are a silly sort of amalgamation of all of our sort of stereotypes and cliches about amateurism, but it is what it is, and I sort of love it on that level because what you see is what you get.
I am looking forward to another potential matchup between the women's hockey teams from the U.S. and Canada. The U.S., at least in recent history, always wins World Championship. The Canadians, at least in recent history, always win the Olympics. It would be a tremendous upset if some team other than those two made it to the finals. I suppose it could happen, but it seems unlikely. I love the idea that the U.S. is talking about putting out a team that is less strict, less disciplined, more free-flying, more likely to surprise us. And I can't wait to see those two teams match up again. And if somebody wants to say women's hockey would be better off if it wasn't Canada and the U.S. facing each other, that's okay. And I also welcome either of you to tell me what you are most looking forward to beyond that. Claire, why don't you start?
Well, my very minor rebuttal to that, you know, I would love to see a U.S.-Canada rematch, but I am very excited to see what Team Korea does in women's hockey when North and South Korea compete together as a unified team. You know, it's in many ways a token partnership, but there's something bigger here. The opening ceremony was all about the themes of peace, and North and South Korea marched in together under a unification flag with both Koreas on it together. And, you know, nothing's ever so simple, but this kind of diplomatic cooperation, the setting aside of politics for even just, you know, a game, is really an example of what the Olympics have the power to be, if not necessarily to do.
And Eric, something other than the enthusiasm for men's hockey bred into you at BU that you're looking forward to?
No, I mean, I think that there's some really great sort of individual storylines. I think skiing and snowboarding, I think I'm really interested to see sort of how Lindsey Vonn does. People generally regard this going to be her last Olympics and sort of the seasoned veteran of the team. And also just to see how Mikaela Shiffrin, what she does for an encore based on what we saw 4 years ago, which was such a fun, I think, and to some extent unexpected breakout party. And then not to sound too like NBC how sad commercial here about this, but I think that there's a lot of really fun personalities to sort of keep track of along the way.
Well, you do sound a little bit like a commercial, but I can't really blame you because what could be better than watching lots of people go downhill very fast on various contrivances?
As long as they stay on their feet by the end, I'm fine with it.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Ringer's Claire McNear and sports writer Eric Malinowski, author of Beta Ball, How Silicon Valley and Science Built One of the Greatest Basketball Teams in History. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
It is that time of year when a lot of people shoveling snow and skidding through stop signs are thinking, Florida. Yeah, Florida. They're thinking walks on the beach, right? And maybe spring training baseball. And some of the people who've already gone south are thinking not about baseball, but about curling, at least according to Bernie Skierkowski.
Nobody's going to admit that they watch curling. But I can guarantee you that when the Olympics are on and the curling comes on, everybody's sitting at home and they're talking about it the next day.
Bernie Skierkowski is the founder of the Tampa Bay Curling Club. He moved to Florida on business 20-odd years ago from Canada.
Curling was a big part of what I grew up with. My father, my family, all were involved in the local curling rink. And so that's where I started and curled all the way up through the junior program up there. So just dropped off when I moved down to Florida.
The curling itself dropped off, but not the enthusiasm for a sport with universal appeal, at least according to Bernie.
It's a sport that everybody and anybody can do. And, you know, you look at figure skating or some of these other winter sports, I don't think any of us have a dream that we'd be able to do that. But anybody can curl. It's an equal and level playing field.
And a slippery one, and I'll get to that. But first things first, and the first thing Bernie Skierkowski had to do when he decided Tampa needed curling was find an icy venue. Turns out there were 7 ice rinks in the Tampa Bay area. Last June, Bernie found one that was amenable to occasional modification for curling, and he put out the call.
We said, well, let's have an interest meeting, thinking we'd have 20 or 25 people. We had standing room over 100 people showed up to listen to us about curling. So that was sort of the trigger that says, well, maybe we've got something here.
Bernie heard from people ranging in age from 15 to 80 and ranging in curling experience from none to some, sort of.
I remember one couple that said, oh yeah, I've curled before. And they pushed off and slid and then sat down in the middle of the rings. And of course, that's not what we want to happen. So I went over and talked to them. I said, do you realize, you know, you're just supposed to stand up? They said, oh no, we've always just sat down and watched the rock go down the ice. And I said, well, let's try to change that.
The change wasn't easy. Curling ice is more slippery than the ice at your local hockey rink. It's covered with tiny, very slippery pebbles over which the stone can glide more easily.
To even make it worse, we put an acrylic slider on our foot to be able to slide down. So that fear of, here's a rock, I'm going to push off with this really slippery thing, and I have no idea what is going to happen.
Wait. Fear? There's an element of fear in curling? Well, okay, maybe for a Florida native who's never seen, let alone walked on ice, but surely not for somebody who knows what he's doing. Somebody like Bernie Skierkowski, who grew up curling in Canada and who may not have anticipated danger on the ice until the day his feet went out from under him while he was giving a lesson.
I broke 2 ribs.
Okay, so fear, danger even, and pain. And for the record, Bernie didn't let 2 broken ribs interrupt that lesson. Maybe because back in Canada, he also used to play hockey. His determination bred enthusiastic pupils, especially a couple of former novices named Scott and Annie.
She curled in the championship game last season and 3 hours later gave birth to their 4th child. And that's how avid they are about curling. And they said, look, we just got another curler for the Tampa Bay Curling Club in 15 years or so. Every Saturday, they come out and, of course, little Evie, their daughter, is with them, and the baby's being watched by somebody as they go out and curl.
Annie and Scott aren't alone in their devotion to the sport. Bernie's club includes a team calling itself Licensed to Curl. The members are determined to move on to competitions or bonspiels beyond Tampa, bonspiels in which they'd face serious international talent. Though, as far as Bernie's concerned, competition at any level isn't really the point.
I should have never had the first season playing for a trophy. Because when we're worried about, you know, a few points here or there in a game to be able to determine who's going to get this trophy that, I mean, it might have cost us $100 type thing, but, you know. And so if I had to do it all over again, I'd probably eliminate the trophy.
Bernie sees the sport as recreational, a great opportunity to get a little exercise and socialize at the bar when the rocks have all found the house. That was a little curling talk there. Anyway, the determination of License to Curl notwithstanding, it may seem unlikely that Bernie's curlers will soon compete successfully against veteran rock sliders from Canada, Scotland, Norway, and various other places where the sport has history and tradition about which Tampa can only dream. But Bernie Skierkowski says participation in curling in the U.S. is bound to explode.
USA Curling only has like 20,000 registered members, I believe, at last count. Think of a population as size as we have, and we only have 20,000 registered curlers in the country. And everywhere I go, I see ice surfaces now. So there's no reason why we can't start incorporating this game and making it bigger and bigger. It's just we haven't yet.
Bernie doesn't think the U.S. is necessarily likely to win a medal in South Korea, but he is certain the U.S. audience for curling will grow during the games, and he says the folks learning the sport from him are already good enough to dream, which is perhaps good enough for him. We were first introduced to Bernie Skierkowski through a story in the New York Times Magazine, and we'll have a link to that story at onlyagame.org. Three generations of Caldwells have competed in the Winter Olympics. This year, Sophie Caldwell has a chance at a medal.
So my family legacy gives me this sense of pride.
Coming up, the story of a Vermont family that spent decades trying to bring cross-country glory to the U.S. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, an interview given by U.S. bobsledder Stephen Holcomb 12 days before his death leads to a conversation about Olympic athletes and mental illness. But right now, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The 2018 Winter Olympics are underway. The games began with an apparently unplanned act of Korean unity. Does the handshake shared by the leaders of North and South Korea seem to you a mere gesture or something more?
Well, we'll see, won't we? You know, the last time that there was the Olympics in South Korea, which was 1988, the North Koreans blew up an airliner to dissuade people from coming. So I think a handshake between a North Korean diplomat and the president of South Korea is certainly a step up from that.
Yeah, I would say so, too.
We'll see what happens after the Olympics, but certainly it was quite a thing to see.
As the world anticipates the Olympic figure skating competition, we have been hearing about bias in the judging of that sport. Not an entirely new charge, as your no suggests. Does this get in the way of your enjoyment of figure skating?
No, because unless the figure skater falls down and gets high marks, I don't know. I mean, do you know the difference between a toe loop and a Lutz? Seriously.
I only know about figure skating judging from the snooty comments of the commentators who
which are great, by the way. Another reason to watch figure skating.
Right.
But as with any judge sport, you're going to have these complications. But I wouldn't know if somebody was getting hosed by the judges.
I don't know how many Olympic medals Norway is going to pile up this time around. But one thing's for sure. They will have at least 15,000 eggs. What?
Yeah, they ordered 1,500 and they got 15,000.
Oh.
Which is great because you can have, you know, virtually unlimited omelets on your way to the curling venue with your funny pants on. But I hope there's not a Norwegian figure skater who gets hosed by the judges because of bias.
Oh, a shower of eggs.
Oh, I'm telling you, eggs make fine projectiles, as the Minnesota Vikings learned on their way out of Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, of course, won Super Bowl LII last Sunday. What happened? Did they fail to read the script?
They played a great game. Both teams played a great. It was a great football game.
Especially if you like offense.
There was no defense whatsoever, which is fine by me, but not by purists. And it was just a really very entertaining football game. And, of course, it was an upset. So unless you had a rooting interest in the Patriots, you liked the outcome.
Jimmy Garoppolo is now drawing the biggest salary in the National Football League. The 49ers opened the vault and allowed nearly $140 million to spill out of it. Will Garoppolo continue to do as well as he did in that brief stint in San Francisco this season?
Oh, he'd better, because now he's the highest paid player in the entire NFL. I mean, he's 26 years old. If he's going to be a great quarterback, it's going to start this year, and he's certainly got something to play for now.
You know, as if he needed a little extra money, he got $79,000 this week because of the Super Bowl bonus that Patriots players got.
I think that's great. I think that's absolutely hilarious.
The NBA trade deadline has come and gone, and who would have guessed that the Cleveland Cavaliers would have all but blown up their team? Isaiah Thomas and Dwayne Wade both gone. Will what they got back in return for those two help them out this year?
No, probably not. I think they've decided to tank the season and go for the draft. I don't see any other explanation for this. They also got rid of Jay Crowder. I mean, they really did strip their lineup.
So either LeBron James was in on this strategy or he's making plans to be somewhere
else, too. Well, that's entirely possible, too.
I know how you love world records, and I got a doozy for you this week. A team of four PGA Tour rookies has set the record for fastest hole played by a foursome. I don't know if we should be impressed by this. I mean, golf isn't supposed to be fast, is it?
It was a par five. They must have knocked the hell out of the ball.
Yeah.
I mean, they played a par five at 27.88 seconds.
I don't know about this, because it feels to me a little bit like setting a record for slowest lap at NASCAR.
Oh, no.
Golf is supposed to be slow.
It's not supposed to be that. I mean, it's not supposed to be as slow as it is. If everybody was forced to play a hole in 27.88 seconds, I'd be a very happy guy.
And finally, as if to reassert that February is the time when we really need a goofy baseball story, the minor league Hartford Yard Goats have announced that they will change their name for one game this summer, and they will become the Hartford Steamed Cheeseburgers because, wait for it, the steamed cheeseburger was invented in Connecticut. I assume you will want a replica jersey.
No, I'm still waiting for my Hartford Yard Goats jersey, but...
Well, maybe they'll come as a package deal.
But I like... First of all, have you ever had a steamed cheeseburger?
I don't even know there was such a thing as a steamed cheeseburger.
To me, it's like team figure skating. I didn't know there was that either.
Fast golf. I don't get it. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In 1976, Bill Koch won a silver medal for the U.S. in cross-country skiing. For the next four decades, no other American reached the Olympic podium in that sport. But one Vermont family has never given up hope. Reporter Rebecca Shear brings us the story.
I don't know how you feel about vanity plates, but the one on John Caldwell's Toyota Prius is spot on. I noticed your license plate. XC Ski?
Yeah, XC Ski. That's my license plate. Yeah. I shuffle along in cross country a little bit, not much.
At age 89, John's had knee problems and multiple hip replacements, hence the shuffling along. But that doesn't stop cross country ski enthusiasts in the United States from hailing John Caldwell as the father, grandfather, godfather, even guru of their sport. After all, he wrote the book on it. 1964's The Cross Country Ski Book. It was the first time anyone had ever written a guide in English.
It's out of print now. Yeah, I went through seven or eight editions. It was a bestseller. I guess it sold over 500,000 copies. It's the only reason I'm not in the poorhouse.
In 1941, when John was in eighth grade, his family moved from small-town Pennsylvania to small-town Vermont. John's father had gotten a job as a business manager at the progressive Putney School. Basketball had been John's game, but Putney didn't have a team. It did have a downhill ski team, which John's dad convinced him to join. And as John recalls, cross-country skiing wasn't on his coach's radar.
In 45, the winter of 45 or 46, we went to the state ski meet. We needed a cross-country skier. We need five cross-country skiers, as a matter of fact. So I volunteered, and I borrowed my little sister's wooden skis. They were about as tall as I was, about 5 feet, and adjusted them to my jumping boots and skied cross-country. That was my first cross-country race.
John's team finished second in that race and got invited to the New England Championships.
And I said, oh boy, well, I've got to train now. So I went out one day in the woods on these skis and trained, but I got tired very quickly. And that was my training. And then I went in the race in the New England Championships, and I think I finished 48th out of 50 or something like that.
John enrolled at Dartmouth College in 1946. For the first time, he got a real pair of cross-country skis and a bit of instruction. As a senior, John went to a Nordic combined ski meet, a mix of ski jumping and cross-country. He beat some guys who'd made the Nordic combined world championship team.
I said, well, this is pretty good. I should try Nordic combined. So I tried Nordic combined the next year and made the Olympic team in 52.
When I ask John to describe his first Olympic experience, I expect to hear nostalgia in his voice or spot a tear in his eye. Instead,
it was terrible.
He laughs.
I've done a lot of sports. through my life, I have never been so poorly prepared for an event. I was 26th out of 26.
No, you're 22nd. We just looked it up here.
That's John's nephew, Zach Caldwell.
22nd?
Yeah, you just got upgraded to 22nd out of 22.
Oh, I knew I was last, but well, you had three jumps in the Olympics for Nordic combined. I fell on the first two. The coach came up to me after I'd fallen twice, and he says, no sense you're taking the third jump. You can't run the cross country unless you stand up once, so why don't you just quit? And I said, no, I'm not going to quit. So I came down the in run in a crouch. I went off in a crouch, and I landed in a crouch, and I stood up so I could run the cross country the next day. I wanted to compete.
John quit racing shortly after the 1952 Winter Olympics, but his feeling of unpreparedness at the Games led him somewhere else.
It gave me impetus to say, this should never happen to anybody again.
So in 1953, John returned to the Putney School as a math teacher and cross country ski coach. The following year, John and his wife Hester, Hep for short, started having kids. And it wasn't long before those kids started skiing.
After they were born and before a year was up when they started to walk, we had plenty of time to get them on skis before they tried walking and got into bad habits. And they would ski around on the rugs in the living room. We put the skis on them, and they'd go skiing. They'd say, oh, this is good. They like that.
One of John's three sons, Sverry, says he doesn't remember skiing around the living room, but he does remember what a low-pressure thing it was, even with a high-profile dad.
You know, we'd ski to school, we'd ski with friends. So it was never about racing. It was just you'd go out and ski.
By this time, John wasn't just coaching students at the Putney School. He was coaching the best skiers in the country on the U.S. ski team. His career advanced quickly. The sport was still young in the U.S., and by now John had gotten some very positive attention from the cross-country ski book. In 1968, John made his Olympic coaching debut at the Winter Games in France. He coached cross-country skiing again at the 1972 Winter Games in Japan. And that was the year another Caldwell made his Olympic debut as a racer. Tim Caldwell was John's eldest son. Tim and his siblings were among John's students at the Putney School. Japan would be the first of four Olympic appearances for Tim. He earned what would ultimately be his highest Olympic finish, sixth place, at the 1976 Winter Games in Austria. Another of John Caldwell's students, Bill Koch, won a silver medal. It was the first and last time an American cross-country skier reached the Olympic podium. In 1989, John Caldwell retired from coaching. In his 30-some years running the team at the Putney School, he'd helped launch the careers of many Olympians. His son Tim, of course, plus Bob Gray, Martha Rockwell, Mike Gallagher, and yes, Bill Koch, the only American cross-country skier to nab a medal at the Winter Olympics. But the next year, something happened that could very well change that. Because on March 22nd, 1990, Sverry Caldwell and his wife Lily welcomed a new baby girl. They named her Sophie.
Let's see. I don't remember when I first learned how to ski because I think I was way too young to remember.
This is Sophie, now 27.
But according to my parents, I'm pretty sure I simultaneously learned how to walk and was put on skis probably around the age of one or just shy of 1 year old.
Sophie says she didn't become serious about racing until much later. In seventh grade, she started cross-country skiing at Stratton Mountain School, a prestigious ski and snowboard academy in Vermont where her dad, Sverry, was head Nordic coach.
And it's funny because I hear horror stories about people who have their parents as their coaches and they hate it, and I can't really relate to that. I loved having my dad as my coach. He did an incredible job of knowing when to be coach and when to be dad. And, you know, dad always comes before coach.
But despite Sophie's enthusiasm for skiing, her main passion was soccer.
You know, my idol was Mia Hamm. I had her biography next to my bed, and I would read that every night before falling asleep.
Then came Sophie's freshman year in high school, when Sverry organized a class trip to a national ski competition in Sweden. On that trip, Sophie had an epiphany.
The biggest skiers in Sweden and Norway and Finland were the equivalent of football players back home. You know, they were the national celebrities, and seeing that skiing really was a big deal in other parts of the world and really ingrained in the culture made me realize that I did want to pursue this in college and potentially beyond.
In 2012, Sophie graduated from Stratton Mountain School and became the fourth Caldwell to ski for Dartmouth College. In 2014, in Sochi, Russia, she became the third Caldwell to ski in the Winter Olympics.
But today, it was Vermont native Sophie Caldwell that made history.
Back in the U.S., in a classroom at Stratton Mountain School, Sverri Caldwell, who's placed more than a dozen Nordic skiers, including Sophie, on Olympic teams, was glued to the TV with his students. A local Vermont news team caught it on camera.
I try to be a pretty calm person, and, you know, it's just like, you know, it's just another race, but my heart was beating. And
during the women's sprint final, Sophie started strong, but then her ski tangled with another racer's pole.
I end up falling in the final, but I think I crossed the line with a huge smile on my face because I never expected to see myself in the Olympic finals in Sochi, and there I was.
Out of six skiers, Sophie finished sixth.
They touted that. They said, that's the highest Olympic finish by a female in cross-country skiing.
But how does John Caldwell feel about his granddaughter's best ever U.S. finish?
Big deal. It's sort of like saying, well, that's the best race he ever ran on Blue Clister on a cloudy day with a full moon or something, you know.
But give her a break.
Give her a break, says Sophie's dad and former coach Sverri. But Sophie says she appreciates her grandfather's frankness. She always has.
My grandpa is a riot, which I'm sure you've found out by now. I pretty much get an email from him after every race, and they're always so funny. You know, I can tell he's really happy for me when I do well, but he also has a tendency to say things like they are, so when they haven't gone well, he doesn't sugarcoat it.
4 years and several World Cup wins after the 2014 Winter Olympics, Sophie Caldwell is competing at the 2018 Winter Olympics. She joins half a dozen of her father's Stratton Mountain School protégés, including her cousin and fellow Dartmouth grad, Patty Caldwell. Here's Sophie again.
I love the sport. You definitely don't get the fame and exposure that you might in other sports, but I think it attracts really good people. So my family legacy gives me this sense of pride, and I think it's something that I hope to continue to show future generations.
This past November, the Caldwell family gathered at the Dartmouth Skiway, a skiing area just north of Dartmouth College, to accept the New England Ski Museum's Spirit of Skiing Award. And it's no surprise. The annual honor goes to an individual or group who personifies an axiom coined by New England downhill ski pioneer Otto Schneebs. Skiing is not just a sport. It is a way of life.
Our story about the Ski Before You Walk Caldwell family was told by reporter Rebecca Shear. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Sousa. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Alex Fracon, who went to North Korea last winter to play ice hockey. But what about that Reddit user who sent out the invitation in the first place?
Wouldn't you know it, they didn't end up going, because this is kind of an intimidating trip.
Yeah, so it was sort of one of those do as I say, not as I do things. Hated that when I was a kid. Still hate it. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.